Tonight I'd like to continue the discussion I began the first night about sudden awakening and gradual cultivation. So what does sudden awakening mean? It's the recognition and the direct experience of the mind's empty, open, aware nature. So I want to read a little something from one of the really great Tibetan Dzogchen masters, Dogo Khenpo Rinpoche. He said, "Mind has no form." Before I go on, as you hear this, as with all Dharma teachings, listen to it not so much to think about it, but the words are really pointing to an experience. So when it's describing the mind, let the words point you to your own experience of the mind. That's how the Dharma should be listened to, as a pointing to, not as a philosophic description. Okay, so mind has no form, no color, and no substance. This is its empty aspect. Yet mind can know things and perceive an infinite variety of phenomena. This is its clear aspect. The inseparability of these two aspects, emptiness and clarity, is the primordial continuous nature of mind. At present, the natural clarity of your mind is obscured by delusions. But as the obscuration clears, you will begin to uncover the radiance of awareness. Until you reach a point where, just as a line traced on water disappears the moment it is made, your thoughts are liberated the moment they arise. To experience mind in this way is to encounter the very source of Buddhahood. So this is what it means, sudden awakening, is to open, even for a moment, to the recognition and experience of this empty knowing, empty clear aspect of mind. This is not something we need to get or something we need to develop. It's rather something we need to recognize and come back to. So during the day, if you find yourselves struggling to be aware, you might remind yourself with a simple little mantra, "It's already here." It's not something we have to look for or get, it's something to come back to. So this is a reminder that the practice is not about wanting or getting, but about letting go into the wisdom mind of non-clinging. Again, Khenpo Rinpoche, awareness basically means freedom from clinging. Awareness basically means freedom from clinging. If there is clinging, it is not awareness. So we can really see that in our practice, non-clinging is the bottom line reference point for all we do, for all the methods. Everything is in the service of the mind that doesn't cling, that doesn't hold on to anything. So then the question arises, if the awakened mind, the awakened state, is already here, if, as the great Thai master Buddhadasa said, there's nothing to do, nothing to be, nothing to have, then what does it mean to speak of gradual cultivation? Right? If the awakened state is already here, what does gradual cultivation mean? It's important to understand that sudden awakening does not mean full enlightenment. It doesn't mean that if we have a moment's recognition of the nature of awareness, that suddenly we're completely enlightened. We may have recognized to some degree this open, empty, knowing nature of mind. But as the Zen master, Shinul, who I mentioned the first night, he goes on to say, although we have awakened to original nature, beginningless habit energies are extremely difficult to remove suddenly. Familiar? Although we have awakened to original nature, beginningless habit energies are extremely difficult to remove suddenly. Hindrances are formidable, and habits are deeply ingrained. So how could you neglect gradual cultivation simply because of one moment of awakening, one moment of recognition? But then he goes on to say something important. But although you must cultivate further, you have already awakened suddenly to the fact that deluded thoughts are originally void and the mind's nature is originally pure. So this is a very interesting way of holding the practice. Shanul is reminding us here that although one moment or many moments of recognizing the nature of awareness, the nature of this open, empty space of mind, even though it is not yet complete, and there's still much work to do, still that understanding transforms the way we continue our practice. Because even as we continue with the gradual cultivation through all of the different methods that we use, we are now proceeding from the understanding that the hindrances and the difficulties that arise in practice are themselves empty and without substance. And so we relate to the hindrances, we relate to the defilements in a very different way. In one description of the Buddha's enlightenment, he's sitting the night of his great awakening under the Bodhi tree in Bodhgaya. And he sat down with the firm resolve not to get up from his seat until he had attained full and complete liberation. Now just for a moment, think of that resolution. Think of coming into the hall here, sitting down. I will not get up from my seat until I've fully awakened. So you can get some sense of the incredible power of the Buddha's mind, Bodhisattva's mind. So as the night progressed, as the story goes, different forces of Mara, and Mara is the embodiment of ignorance and delusion, different forces of Mara appeared in his mind. And it said that there were these terrifying visions of violence and aggression and very seductive visions of all the heavenly pleasures. And then in this way of describing that night, there's one line which really jumped out at me and has been a great inspiration for understanding just the essence of what we're practicing. That in the face of all these fearsome and enticing appearances, it said, and the mind of the great being was not moved. You know, and I just love that possibility, that in the face of whatever arises, the most fearsome things, the most enticing things, the mind of the great being was not moved. So this can be the pole star of our own practice. Now, and as we go through the day, in whatever posture we're in, whether we're sitting or walking or engaged in different activities, we can really watch to see, are we pulled out of awareness? When are we pulled out of awareness? What has the power in our own experience to move the mind? How is our mind seduced? So there are many different levels of this, and I'm sure you're familiar with almost all of them. You know, we often are seduced or we get lost in strong emotions. You know, we get pulled out of awareness and we get lost in the emotion, or we can get lost just in fantasies and stories and fleeting thoughts. On a more subtle level, we can get lost in identification with awareness itself. That becomes another place of getting caught. So the Buddha helps us out here by identifying and highlighting some particularly seductive energies. You know, habit patterns of mind that capture most of us again and again. And it's essential that we learn to recognize these deeply ingrained habits, and some of which are traditionally in Buddhism called the hindrances, and to explore not only their nature, you know, what are the nature of these mind states, what is the nature, but also to begin to explore their particularly seductive power. Why is it that we get caught in them again and again? When we investigate in this way, when we have interest in these forces in the mind, these habitual tendencies, then we can experience the hindrances not as some personal problem that we're having, or even particularly as a difficulty in the practice. But rather, when they arise, if we have the interest and the willingness, we can investigate them and understand for ourselves just the dynamic interplay between ignorance and awareness, between suffering and freedom. It's playing out all through the day. You know, and so if we're taking interest in our lives, and we're watching these different hindrances or difficult energies arising, we see, we're looking to see, okay, how are we getting caught? What is their nature? What is the allure? Looking to see when we come out of them, emerge from them back into awareness. We're just watching this play of ignorance and wisdom. We're watching the play of suffering and freedom very directly. This is not philosophy anymore. There's a Tibetan saying that the stronger the passion or the stronger the emotion, the stronger the awareness. You know, so when I first heard that, what does that mean? The stronger the passion, the stronger the awareness or wisdom. It means that as we practice mindful awareness in the face of strong, seductive emotions and mind states, the awareness itself becomes stronger and more stable. You know, when we're really being mindful of these strong energies, it makes the awareness very stable, very powerful. So can we practice through the day? Can we keep in mind in our practice, as we work with the different qualities in the mind, the different emotions, the different hindrances, can we practice like the Bodhisattva? The mind of the great being was not moved. Can we use that as an example for ourselves? So there are a few steps in this process. How can we do it? The first step, you know, and it's obvious, is recognition. We need to practice recognizing the telltale signs of the different hindrances, because they often come masquerading as something good and skillful. And this is their very tricky nature. They come masquerading as something skillful, and then we get fooled by their disguise. So we need to learn to recognize the particular sign so we're not fooled. And tonight I'd like to speak in particular of two of these hindrances, beginning with the mind state of doubt. Now the word doubt in English can refer to two quite different states. One is helpful and one is not so helpful. The helpful meaning of doubt, or quality of doubt, is that quality of investigation, of inquiry. What is this? What is the nature of this? What's happening? Now, in Zen, it's sometimes called the great doubt, where we're really holding this very powerful questioning of the nature of what's happening. And so this kind of doubt is the opposite of dogmatic belief. Right? So this is very skillful. This is the energy of wisdom. The unskillful aspect we could call skeptical doubt. And this is the mind state of uncertainty and indecision. So just imagine yourselves at a crossroads and not knowing which way to go. And the mind just going back and forth between the alternatives and not going anywhere. That's the manifestation of doubt. Skeptical doubt, when it is unnoticed, is a tremendously powerful force, powerful hindrance, because it can bring our practice to a standstill. If this doubt, if this indecision, if this perplexity is operating in the mind and we don't notice it, we just don't do anything. We don't go anyplace. When this kind of doubt is strong, it doesn't even give us the opportunity to take a wrong turn and learn from our mistakes. It's really a paralyzing quality. It's like we're frozen in indecision. We're always checking ourselves, you know, wondering what to do, trying to decide. Some years ago, there was a wonderful novel called The Life of Pi by Jan Martel. And there's one line in it which is really wonderful. He said, "To choose doubt as a philosophy of life is akin to choosing immobility as a means of transportation." That really captures the nature of doubt. So in meditation, doubt takes some very particular forms. And if we pay attention carefully to our minds, we can learn to recognize the patterns of doubt that entice us again and again. So it could be, for example, doubting thoughts about the practice. What does sitting here, feeling my breath, have to do with anything? What does it have to do with the suffering in the world? It seemed pretty useless. Doubting thought. Or we might start comparing practices. You know, many of you have probably studied with different teachers, each with different perspectives. So we get caught up in the question, well, who's right? You know, and just comparing and judging and not doing anything. The comparing mind just leads to doubt and confusion. We might start comparing practices. Maybe I should be doing Tibetan chanting. You know, or Sufi dancing. They seem to be having more fun. All of this is the doubting mind. Perhaps even more debilitating, even in these kind of doubts that commonly arise for people in the practice at different times, there's the very strong and enticing mind state of self-doubt, doubting our ability to practice. Am I doing this right? I can't do it. It's too hard. It's not the right time. I'll come to a retreat next year. Things will be better. All of those thoughts of self-doubt. When the pattern of self-doubt is strong in us, it's not only a hindrance in the meditation practice, it also becomes a very debilitating force in our lives. Now, when self-doubt is strongly conditioned, we're always checking ourselves. We're always holding back. There's an interesting phrase in English which is very telling. We say someone is plagued by doubt. Doubt is like a plague, you know, that weakens the mind. Instead of making the experiment, whether it's in meditation or any other activity of our lives, instead of just engaging fully and doing something and then seeing for ourselves, is this helpful or not, beneficial or not, you simply get lost in this endless speculation, this endless thinking about because of the self-doubt. And then the doubt becomes self-fulfilling because staying lost in the doubting mind really is useless. Nothing gets accomplished. It doesn't allow us the opportunity to investigate for ourselves. It just, we stay held back. So this endless conjecturing in the mind, it's exhausting and it's painful. In the texts, it's likened to a thorny mind, you know, that keeps jabbing. And really, it's like that. I don't know if you reflect on the times when your mind might be caught by this hindrance of doubt, either self-doubt or doubt about the practice, doubt about what you're doing here. It's just like the mind is continually getting jabbed, you know, by each of these thorny thoughts. And we feel irritable. We feel dissatisfied. We feel discouraged. Sometimes self-doubt is fed by deep feelings of unworthiness. You know, that can be an underlying emotion which just keeps feeding the self-doubt. At one point at a teaching with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, somebody was kind of asking a question about the practice and saying how difficult it was because they didn't feel worthwhile as a person. You know, so it's very, it was a moment, you know, when this person expressed this. And then the Dalai Lama did something, I've rarely seen him kind of respond. It was like a, just like the sword of wisdom. You know, usually he's so smiley and laughy and, you know, gentle. But here, when the person said this, you know, I don't feel worthwhile as a person, he said, you're wrong. You're absolutely wrong. You are deceiving yourself. And I thought, it was just such a powerful moment because it was just reflecting back that is really a self-deception given the intrinsic awakened nature of mind that we all share. It's not that some people have it and some people don't. So the feeling of not being worthwhile as a person is delusion. It may be deeply conditioned pattern, you know, and there may be causes and conditions behind it, but it is never true. And the Dalai Lama was just putting that out very directly and very strongly. So we need to really look at that and see that if that's a particularly seductive pattern for us. The Buddha summed up all of this when he spoke of doubt and all the other hindrances in this way. He said, when we attend to them carelessly, that is the hindrances, they cause lack of vision, lack of knowledge, are detrimental to wisdom, tending to vexation, leading away from awareness. That's pretty direct. When we don't attend to these mind states carefully, it leads to all of those things. I love that little phrase, tending to vexation, because it certainly does. So given that, you know, that it leads to all of these things, away from vision, away from awareness, tending to vexation, given all this, we might wonder, why would we ever be caught up in them? Why do we get seduced by these unskillful states of mind? If we can recognize doubt or any of the other hindrances when it arises, and we have an attitude of interest and inquiry, the second step in the process is to really understand what is its allure. Okay, doubt arises, we see that it's there, and so then we look, well, what's seductive about it? We begin to see that the great seduction of the doubting mind is that it comes masquerading as wisdom. We hear this very wise sounding voice in our minds, and this voice sounds so reasonable and so valid and so true. What's the point of doing this? I really can't do this, you know. It's too hard. Maybe some other time. So we want to recognize that wise sounding voice that's really doubt, right? And not be fooled by its disguise. In life situations, in ordinary life situations, we might have doubt about two choices, two alternatives, and we're just going back and forth between the two, caught up in endless loops. And we have the idea that this endless thinking back and forth is actually wise investigation. If it goes on for more than 3.5 minutes, it's probably not wise investigation. It's probably just that doubting mind of perplexity. Now, there's an interesting situation that gives rise to this, and it's something I had a very direct experience of. Sometimes we find it difficult to accept that in some situations, we actually might not yet know what the best thing to do is. There are two choices, two alternatives, and we actually don't know. But the feeling of not knowing, for many people, is very uncomfortable. You know, maybe it brings up insecurity or... And because the feeling of not knowing is so uncomfortable, rather than simply rest in the unknowing until things become clearer, we try to figure things out through thought. And as I say, we can give some thought to it, but at a certain point, it's just this endless looping. A little helpful mantra in these situations might be, it's okay not to know. It's okay not to know. It's okay to be in the uncertainty. When we can be accepting of that, it's a great relief. You know, because then we don't feel the inner pressure or tension to have to make a decision when we're not clear, when we don't know, we don't fully understand the situation yet. So if we can become aware of doubt, the doubting mind, as just another passing thought, and we don't give the doubt any power, it doesn't mean that they stop coming. It means that we see them, we recognize them, we don't give them power. We see these doubting thoughts for what they are. There can be a sudden awakening to their empty, insubstantial nature. In recognizing doubt as doubt, we are already aware. we're already abiding in awareness when we recognize doubt as doubt. And it's just this quality of awareness. And the mind of the great being was not moved. Doubt arises, whatever arises, the mind is not moved because we're seeing clearly. So another mind state that often powerfully conditions our lives is the mind state of aversion. And this can come in various forms. Aversion comes in the form of anger, comes in the form of hatred, annoyance, irritation, fear, ill will, self-judgment, judgment of others. Now, all of these mind states are conditioned reactions to what we find unpleasant. Right? What do we feel aversion towards? We generally don't feel aversion towards the pleasant. Mostly feel aversion towards what's unpleasant. As with doubt, we can learn to recognize all of these states of aversion when they arise. Investigate their nature, and then really look to see what is their hold on our minds. What's the allure of aversion, of anger, of fear? Why do we get pulled into them? Aversion arises in some pretty predictable ways. It's easy to see it in relationship to physical pain. And how often are you sitting and you begin to feel some physical discomfort and say, oh, good. Probably not that often. When physical discomfort, when pain arises, the conditioned reaction, we can feel the contraction, the fear, the not liking, the frustration, the impatience. You recognize that. Mostly with physical pain, we just don't like it. We don't want it. The contraction of our energy system is a clear signal that some kind of aversion is present. You know, if you're feeling yourself getting tighter and tighter and tense, it's probably because there's aversion arising in the mind. Aversion often arises in the mind when we think about painful or unpleasant past experiences. You know, there may be a thought or an image arising in the mind of someone or some event that has happened in the past, and we get angry just thinking about it. You know, if it was a difficult situation, an unpleasant situation, it comes to mind, and we get angry about it. But in that moment, what's happening is that we're really getting angry at a thought. One of the lines my first teacher, Munindraji, used very often, and it's been with me, you know, for 40 years. He used to say very often, the thought of your mother is not your mother. It's a thought. And you could substitute anything for mother. The thought of whatever is not a whatever. It's a thought. It's so amazing that we don't see this. You know, and that these thoughts can arise, or these images can arise, and we can get angry, we can get afraid, we can get upset at a thought. What's even more remarkable is we can get angry about imagined or anticipated future situations. They haven't even happened, but we think that they might happen. And we play out a whole little fantasy in our mind and get angry or upset or anxious or whatever it might be. It's really quite remarkable how we're living our lives. So we need to see. We need to see how this is happening, because it's so freeing when we do. We can get impatient or frustrated with unpleasant situations on retreat or with difficulties in our practice. And then, I don't know if you've noticed this, but I've seen this in myself. You know, if there's some kind of difficulty or frustration that I'm experiencing in my practice, very often, and often unknowingly, it will get projected onto other people. And they can do the most innocuous things, and we get so irritated by them. It really has nothing to do with them. You know, there's something in retreat jargon called the Vipassana Vendetta. You know, where there's somebody on retreat you just can't stand. You know, you don't like the way they walk, you don't like the way they eat, you don't like the way they dress. And you probably don't even know them. But the mind is just creating this whole fantasy of aversion. And it's usually rooted in some difficulty within oneself that's not being open to. It's a projection. Aversion or anger can arise when we personalize different situations that are really quite impersonal. You go to the airport 2 hours early, plenty of time. You look on the board, flight is canceled. You know, what's the reaction in the mind? You know, maybe for you, and you know, as a result of our practice, we're in perfect equanimity. But it's easy to see in oneself and in others in that situation a lot of irritation, a lot of annoyance, a lot of frustration, taking it personally, where it's clear that it's a situation completely outside of our control. Sometimes with aversion, it's being fed by other emotions. You know, so it's like an underground spring which is feeding the aversion. And if we don't see that, then we stay locked in. Quite a few years ago, I was teaching a retreat for lawyers, law students, some judges. You know, so it's kind of the legal community. It was pretty interesting. And there was one second or third degree law student, and he was talking about just, you know, the law is an adversarial situation, and sometimes it gets very intense. And he said that in that kind of confrontation, that he had to get angry so that he wouldn't feel the fear. And that was so interesting to me, you know, that because feeling the fear was unacceptable to him, so he needed to project it out in anger so as not to feel it. And in the course of the retreat and the discussion, we spent some time talking about and learning it's okay to feel fear, that we can be accepting of the fear and still act. The fear doesn't have to limit us. And then we can act not out of anger, not out of aggression or aversion, but in whatever way is skillful. So sometimes these underlying emotions actually are feeding our anger. We need to really see that and understand it. So given all these different forms of aversion, of anger, of hatred, of ill will, of frustration, of annoyance, of impatience, you know, there are many forms. So given all this and how unpleasant they mostly are, again we need to ask the question, what is their seduction? It doesn't feel good. So why do we get pulled in to these emotions again and again in our lives. One of the seductions of anger is that very sweet feeling of being right. I should be angry or irritated or annoyed. Look at what's happening. Look at what that person is doing. Of course I should be angry. The Buddha described it this way. He said, anger with its poisoned source and honeyed tip. And isn't it just like that? You know, when we really look at the source of the anger, the root, it is a kind of poison in us. And yet, the tip is so sweet. You know, it's the honeyed tip. So there are many different ways, skillful means of dealing with aversion in the mind. Sometimes, if our awareness is well honed, just a moment of recognition is enough. You know, we awaken in the moment that there's an angry thought or a moment of irritation. If the awareness is right there, we just see it arising. We see its empty, insubstantial nature. It's almost like just watching a movie of the mind. And we're not caught. You know, we just see it arise and pass away. We're not hooked on the bait, by the bait of self-righteousness. There was one Tibetan teacher, Chechen Gyaltsop, said, if you don't cling, whatever arises is naturally freed. And that's just a wonderful thing to remember. If we don't cling, whatever arises, impatience, annoyance, anger, unworthiness, whatever it is, doubt, if we don't cling, whatever arises is naturally freed. And that's the beauty of recognizing the sudden awakening, the nature of the mind. We can understand, and we do understand more and more as our practice deepens, what the Buddha said so often in his teachings. He said, all phenomena should be seen with perfect wisdom. This is not I, this is not mine, this is not myself. Just imagine what our minds would be like if we could view all phenomena arising from that perspective. This is not I, this is not mine, this is not myself. So we're not pushing anything away, we're not holding on to anything. We're just allowing for this flow of phenomena to roll on. Often though, as we know, we do get caught. We can recognize that the fear or the aversion is there, but we keep getting lost in the powerful story that it's telling us. You know, and it usually is a pretty powerful story. Sometimes the emotion actually is telling us something important. So it's not to completely disregard the message. Because sometimes the anger might arise at real injustice. Sometimes the anger or fear might be saying, we need to set some boundaries. You know, and so there is often an important message in the emotion. We want to hear that and understand it and assess whether there's something important here or not. But can we understand the message of it without being overwhelmed by the emotion, without being caught by it, without acting it out? It's very helpful, not only with these hindrances, with aversion or anger or annoyance, but with all experiences, and it's something I mentioned, it's very helpful to check the attitude in the mind about what's arising, in this case, aversion. because we may recognize it, we may understand its nature, we may even see its allure, understand why it's capturing us, but we may also be holding it in a way that is actually feeding it. So we need to check our attitude. How are we relating to the anger? How are we holding it? Beside the honeyed tip of self-righteousness, there may well be feelings of aversion toward the anger. We don't like it. Or there might be self-judgment about it arising. Well, that's not going to be that helpful. Because if we're trying to get rid of aversion out of aversion, we're just strengthening the whole system. We're just locking it in. It's important to understand that all of these hindrances, these difficult emotions, are not intrinsic to the mind. They're not intrinsic to awareness. They all appear as visitors. They're just visitors to the mind. They're like cloud formations in the sky. These visitors come when the certain causes and conditions are there, conditions change, the hindrances, the emotions disappear. But with some of them, they've come so frequently, and we've become so identified with them, we think they actually live here. You know, we think that they are home. And forgetting their impermanent, insubstantial nature, we struggle. There's a story of Milarepa, the great Tibetan master, saint, you know, many centuries ago. It said that when he was practicing, at one point he was living in a cave and he was hounded by all kinds of demons, which are really these, you know, unskillful patterns in the mind. And he was struggling and he tried everything, you know, to deal with them. And they were just getting stronger and stronger and more powerful. And of course, in the Tibetan iconography, you know, they really have very graphic representations of the demons, but they're really manifestations, you know, forces in the mind. So he struggled and struggled, and they were getting bigger and stronger and more powerful. And it said then he checked his attitude, and he saw that he had aversion to them. He was struggling against them. And so then he shifted his attitude and started looking upon them with compassion. And he said that he visualized his body as nectar, you know, and he started feeding the demons. And as soon as his mind opened to these demons of the mind with compassion, they all disappeared. So it's a nice kind of imagery for, or a reminder for us to look, how are we relating to these forces that are arising in the mind? We need to check our attitude, because we may be unwittingly feeding them even as we're trying to get rid of them. Thich Nhat Hanh just has a beautiful way of expressing this. He said, the Buddhist attitude is to take care of anger. We don't suppress it. We don't run away from it. We just breathe and hold our anger in our arms with utmost tenderness. The anger is no longer alone. It is with our mindfulness. If you keep breathing, mindfulness particles will infiltrate the anger. If you keep shining your compassion and understanding on it, your anger will soon crack and you will be able to look into its depths and see its roots. You know, and so, as usual with Thich Nhat Hanh, he just has this wonderful tenderness about how to relate to experience. And mindfulness allows us to see things clearly. Now, as I mentioned, I think this morning, if we're struggling with these hindrances, if we're struggling with anything, it always signifies non-acceptance. It means in some way we're not including something. We're not letting something in. So I want to read to you a wonderful poem about exclusion and inclusion. It's a poem by Billy Collins called Another Reason I Don't Keep a Gun in the House. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. He is barking the same high rhythmic bark that he barks every time they leave the house. They must switch him on their way out. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. I close all the windows in the house and put on a Beethoven symphony full blast, but I can still hear him muffled under the music, barking, 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 and now I can see him sitting in the orchestra. His head raised confidently, as if Beethoven had included a part for barking dogs. When the record finally ends, he is still barking, sitting there in the oboe section, barking, his eyes fixed on the conductor who is entreating him with his baton, while the other musicians listen in respectful silence to the famous barking dog solo. That endless coda that first established Beethoven as an innovative genius. I really think that poem says it all. When we're not mindful, when we're not aware, all of the hindrances, all of the difficult energies, all of the barking dogs obscure the natural wisdom of mind. And when we are mindful of them, when we're inclusive, when the barking dog is just part of the orchestra, we allow whatever's arising to appear, to change, to disappear in this open, empty, aware space of mind. With this quality of understanding, then the hindrances themselves become a vital part of our practice. They become a vital part of this whole path of awakening. So I would suggest whenever you are facing a difficulty, you know, or struggling with something, just put a very soft mental note on the experience, barking dog solo. That's all it is. Can you sit back and listen to it? Okay, so I'll just close with one teaching from one of the most famous of the Thai forest masters. He was considered an arhant, a fully enlightened being, and he was kind of the father of the Thai forest tradition. His name was Ajahn Mun. He said, of all the many things that people value and care for in the world, the mind is the most precious. In fact, the mind is the foremost treasure in the whole world, so be sure to look after it well. To realize the mind's true nature is to realize the Dhamma. Understanding the mind is the same as understanding Dhamma. Once the mind is known, then Dhamma in its entirety is known. Arriving at the truth about one's mind is the attainment of Nibbana. Clearly, the mind is a priceless possession that should never be overlooked. So this is really our practice together. Let's sit for a couple of minutes.